Society's Faculty Division, and on behalf of the Federalist Society and the American Enterprise Institute, seventh of our co-sponsored series on important new books about law and public policy that we and AI have been co-sponsoring over the past year and a half, roughly. Today's event is, of course, about arbitration in the Constitution, and we're delighted to be able to do this program growing out of Professor Beau Rutledge's book on the topic. We scheduled this to make sure that only people who were really seriously interested in arbitration of the Constitution would be here. That is to say, you know, the Supreme Court seems to be preoccupied with some other matters over the current 2 days, but we're delighted to see that we nonetheless have people who are interested in this topic. Without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Michael Greva, who is both a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, or a visiting fellow, or whatever that title is, and also a professor of law at George Mason University Law School. Michael.
Thank you, Lee. I don't know what my title here is either, but I seem to be in charge of moderating events on books that cost $99 and come from Cambridge University Press. The last one was David Skeel and Peter Conte Brown on state bankruptcy. Today it's Beau Rutledge on arbitration and the Constitution. In the spirit of the day here, I'm the moderator or maybe the arbitrator, and I thought we'd do an experiment. The gentlemen have committed all procedural decisions to my sole discretion, and so I rule that we all talk at the same time. And if they don't like it, we'll see whether Judge Brown grants relief under Section 10. Twenty-minute introduction. Fix this. 15-minute or 20-minute introduction. Brief summary of some of the themes on the book. James Chen will go second, and John Vail will bat cleanup here. I should say we're particularly grateful to John for doing this on really, really short notice. So thank you all for being here. Why don't we start, Beau?
Is it better if I stay here? It sounds like this mic is working, and so as long as you all are not put off by my sitting. When I speak to a audience with such a mixture of lawyers, judges, law professors, and the like, my thoughts naturally drift back to an occasion about 6 years ago when I was attending career day at my four-year-old school. Lest you think that my daughter attended some school that, you know, was driving into kids they had to be when they were four, this was not an exercise in what you would become. Rather, this was an exercise in public speaking and being confident in your feet. And so we all sat in a circle, and the teacher said, could you please introduce your mom? My mom is a judge. Well, what does a judge do? Well, she dispenses justice and applies the law. And my dad's a lawyer. And what does a lawyer do? And a lawyer fixes people's problems. And came around to my daughter, who had unfortunately suffered through one of my classes as a result of a childcare emergency, and just the preceding week. And so when they came to Anna, without missing a beat, she said, this is my father. He's a law professor. Well, Anna, what does a law professor do? And she said, well, a law professor talks all the time. And he asks lots of questions, but he never answers them. And so, humbled as I was by my child's description, not entirely inapt of my profession, I'm reminded of the fact that my job should be more than just to talk all the time or ask questions. I will keep within time, Michael. And against that backdrop, hopefully raise some questions as well. I would be remiss, too, if I didn't thank a few people. The first person whom I most want to thank is not here, and that's my wife. For those of you who have written books, you know that those do not write themselves, and they require sacrifices not simply by the author but also by the family. She's home with our four children, preparing her German lectures for tomorrow. She has the privilege of teaching at the University of Georgia, and I wouldn't be here. This book wouldn't be here without her. Second person is here, and that's my dean, Rebecca White. She's been the dean at the University of Georgia. She's the reason why I'm there. She's the reason why this book is here. When I came to the University of Georgia, the best way I can describe it is that this book was a lump of clay, and to the extent it's been sculpted at all, it's been thanks to her support, and I'm honored that she would take the time out of her busy schedule to be here. And last, I need to thank the number of colleagues and former students, some of whom are here, some of whom are not, who have contributed to this book in innumerable ways. When you think about the title, Arbitration in the Constitution, the first thought that may occur to you is that these are quite strange bedfellows. We think about arbitration, at least in general terms, as a means by which private parties opt out of the state-run system of dispute resolution and submit their dispute to a private decision maker, the results of whose decisions will be presumptively binding on them. By contrast, we think about the Constitution as regulating a very different set of relationships. It may regulate horizontal relationships, such as the distribution of power between branches of government. It may regulate vertical relationships, such as the distribution of power between the federal government and the states. Or it may regulate the relationship between the state and the individual, such as in the various guarantees of rights in the Constitution. What the Constitution, with rare exception, does not regulate is the relationship between private individuals entirely. So why would a document that seems to say very little about private relationships have anything to do with what is essentially, at least in general terms, a private relationship to take a dispute out of the court system and resolve it by submitting it to someone like Professor Grieva? And the answer, I would suggest, is that for many years, these two doctrines, these two areas of law, were indeed strange bedfellows. For, as many of you know, for the first century and a half of the country's history, arbitration clauses, at least pre-dispute arbitration clauses, were unenforceable. They were deemed contracts that divested courts of jurisdiction and thus were void as contrary to public policy. The Federal Arbitration Act, when enacted in 1925, was in part an effort to change the course of this historical dislike of arbitration agreements. But even then, arbitration agreements were relatively limited. For about the next 50 years, a doctrine that many of you may be familiar with, the non-arbitrability doctrine, reigned, that sucked out of the system what we might consider public disputes in the sense that they arose under federal statutes, the antitrust laws, the securities laws, the theory there being that the submission of these sorts of disputes to private decision makers was inconsistent with Congress's intent in both creating a cause of action under these statutes and vesting federal courts with jurisdiction over them. Thus, between the non-arbitrability doctrine and the historical unenforceability of arbitration agreements, if you will, a wall grew up between arbitration law and constitutional law. But that wall didn't always exist. To give you two historical examples, in the French Constitution of 1793, that constitution guaranteed the right of the citizens finally to resolve their dispute through arbitrators of their choice, and that this right cannot in any respect be decreased by law. But perhaps more interestingly, when the National Socialists came to power in Germany, they scrapped laws in Bavaria and Prussia that, like the French Constitution, guaranteed citizens the right to arbitrate under the following rationale. According to the guidelines of the National Socialist Republic, from a state political point of view, a further spread of arbitration would shatter confidence in state jurisdiction and the state itself. So given these historical precedents from places like France, Germany, why has the Constitution been such an absent partner in arbitration law? And what I would suggest is that, in fact, it hasn't. Since about the 1970s, maybe even to the 1960s, constitutional law has begun to exert a profound influence in arbitration law. But that influence has not come in the way that we might expect to learn in constitutional law, that there are doctrines that expressly constrain arbitration in certain ways. Rather, if you accept this metaphor of the wall, the influence that the Constitution imposes on arbitration is subtle. It's more like a seepage as opposed to a flood. And it's that seepage that this book tries to describe and to a certain extent critique. Now, in trying to think about how to reduce this book into a 15 to 20 minute presentation, I sought the advice of Richard Epstein, whom some of you may know. And Richard's advice was quite simple. He said, as with all successful talks, don't try to summarize the whole. Be earnest and unruffled. Now, what exactly Richard meant by that, I'm not sure, but at the end of this, you can decide whether I've been earnest and unruffled. I can assure you I won't try to summarize the whole. Let me begin by giving you the thesis. Over the past half century, constitutional norms increasingly have worked their way into our arbitration law. And to a lesser extent, arbitration law has influenced the development of constitutional norms. This seepage between the two disciplines has not occurred with a great deal of systematic thought or deliberation. It tends to take place through incremental developments in various fields of arbitration, often occurring in isolation with each other and with little consideration of the broader implications for our Constitution. In some cases, this seepage has occurred through statutory interpretation. In some cases, it has occurred through the design of treaties or statutes. But perhaps most interestingly, this seepage has also occurred through the development of private constitutional norms that influence arbitration law no more or no less than if a court simply imposed upon arbitration those constitutional norms directly. So in the remaining time, let me give you a few examples. One, judicial review. We know from the Constitution that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and such inferior courts as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. And Article III proceeds to give 9 heads of jurisdiction that the federal courts generally may share with the state courts, but Congress may vest in the federal courts exclusively. Article III, and Jim Chen may talk about this some in his remarks because he wrote a very important article addressing this in the context of NAFTA. Article III has served as the basis for a number of challenges to arbitration, both at the international level and at the domestic level. They have almost entirely been unsuccessful. And the dominant account for why they've been unsuccessful, though this wouldn't necessarily apply in the NAFTA cases that Professor Chen may talk about, can be traceable to the Supreme Court's decision in CFTC versus Shore. The CFTC versus Shore, as you may know, has very little to do with arbitration. It has to do largely with the ability of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to hear a common law claim that the parties decided to submit to it. But the Supreme Court, missing no opportunity to create mischief in dicta, proceeds to say, in such circumstances where the parties voluntarily submit their dispute to the CFTC, separation of powers concerns are diminished. For it seems self-evident that just as Congress may encourage parties to settle a dispute out of court, or resort to arbitration, without impermissible incursions in the separation of powers, Congress may make available a quasi-judicial mechanism through which willing parties may, at their option, elect to resolve their differences. In other words, parties could consent away the right to go to Article III courts. Now, as I explained in some detail in the book, although most courts have rejected challenges to arbitration on Article III grounds on reliance on Shore's consent notion, that's been far too facile a view. If you think about it, for one thing, it's sort of odd to say that that Article III, which we consider largely as speaking to the division of power within our government, is actually conferring a constitutional right that can be waived. Framers knew how to embed personal rights in Article III. They did it. They embedded in Article III a right to a criminal jury trial. Indeed, they thought about but rejected a right in Article III of a civil jury trial, which is part of the reason why it ended up in the Seventh Amendment, as opposed to Article III. But wholly apart from the fact that consent theory can't be reconciled with either with history, the text, or the structure, even the mere fact that one talks about consent can't answer the argument. For Shore itself recognized that there's a non-waivable, structural element to Article III. And so Shore begs the question, why exactly, if there is a non-waivable element to Article III, does arbitration not violate it? Suppose, for example, Congress enacts a statute that basically says federal courts shall enforce without any judicial review whatsoever whatever an arbitrator says. Would that in some way intrude upon the power of federal courts just because parties have constitutionally waived the right to have their dispute litigated in the federal forum? And this is more than just a hypothetical concern. That is, in a sense, exactly what Congress has done when it ratified the Washington Convention of 1965. Now, most of you probably never heard of the Washington Convention of 1965 because it's never actually been invoked against the United States. But what the Washington Convention of 1965 does is it says that any state that is a party to a bilateral investment treaty, and the U.S. is party to about 40, that then goes to arbitration may have the awards under the Washington Convention of 1965 enforced without any judicial review whatsoever. And the only reason why that hasn't been invoked against the United States yet is that the United States has never lost a bilateral investment arbitration. But if and when it does, this issue will arise. So we need something more than just Shor's facile consent theory to explain why arbitration is compatible with Article III. And in the book, I walk through some of the traditional theories of Article III, textualist theory, literalist theory, story of Mars theory that we might differentiate between cases and controversies. Ultimately, I seize upon his theory that Richard Fallon developed in the administrative agency context, what's referred to as appellate review theory. The idea that the scope of federal judicial review must be tied to the underlying functions that federal courts serve. Fallon says, on the one hand, in certain circumstances, federal courts reinforce separation of powers. They provide fairness to litigants. They ensure integrity to the process. On the other hand, other institutions, whether they be administrative agencies or arbitrators, may provide expertise. They may provide flexible procedures. There may be sovereign immunity concerns that justify taking a case out of federal court. The case may involve government functions. And so what I try to do in the chapter is map the basic insight of Fallon's modified arbitration review theory, excuse me, appellate review theory, onto arbitration. And essentially what I say is that in many respects, Fallon's theory maps fine. The challenge, of course, becomes what do we do in a situation where a arbitrator renders a decision on federal law that is patently wrong? Is a federal court truly neutered in its ability to correct that? Now, in some nations, the answer is unequivocally yes. But in the United States, we have an escape hatch, or at least we seem to still have an escape hatch. And that is, depending on how you classify it, either the doctrine that that awards can be reviewed for manifest disregard of the law, or at least since the Supreme Court's decision in the Stolt-Nielsen case, the idea that the arbitrators can exceed their power when they resolve their dispute in a way that is inconsistent with the party's agreement. And what I would suggest to you is that we can think about manifest disregard of the law, or Section 10A4, as a kind of constitutional avoidance principle, that by preserving for the federal courts some opportunity to peek behind the merits of the arbitrator's decision, that what we are doing is we are reinforcing the constitutional value that people like Story, Amar, and Richard Fallon are debating. In other words, Article III values are being vindicated not by subjecting arbitration to Article III, but how the Federal Arbitration Act itself is being interpreted. Example 2. Federalism. We know from Article 6 that the Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, and anything of the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. Preemption. Now, we might say, arbitration, federal matter, federal law, end of story. But as Andy Pincus perhaps knows better than anyone else, Andy being responsible for many, Andy being, I think, probably the finest litigator in the country when it comes to many things, including arbitration matters, knows, the story is not so simple. Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act says, a written provision in any contract evidencing a transaction involving commerce to settle by arbitration a controversy arising out of such contract shall be irrevocable and enforceable save upon such grounds as exist at law or in equity for the revocation of any contract. Section 2 immediately raises two questions. One, where does this apply? And two, to what law should a court look in deciding whether or not there is a ground at law or in equity for the revocation of any contract? Now, the Supreme Court answered the first question in Southland Core versus Keating, something I know that John Vail, whom I'm so grateful for stepping in here, will talk about. And it said that Section 2 applies both in federal and state court. A controversial holding, to be sure, given the fact that many other sections of the Federal Arbitration Act spoke specifically about the United States District Courts, but one that clearly was motivated by the court's concern that if it reached an alternative conclusion, that Congress's attempt to counteract the history of discrimination against arbitration clauses could be circumvented by the simplicity of form shopping. But on the other hand, what the court has done as to the second question, what law applies, has counterbalanced this anti-federalist impulse. For what the court said in the first options case, at least since 1995, is that state law, not federal law, supplies the grounds for revocation of any contract, but not all state law. These must be generally applicable contract principles. In other words, if a state were to enact a law that says arbitration agreements and employment contracts shall not be enforceable, Section 2 of the FAA preempts that because it puts arbitration clauses on a different footing than other contracts. On the other hand, if a state were to say contracts that violate public policy are unenforceable, and it is the public policy of our state that certain rights must be heard in court, therefore we will not allow the enforcement of arbitration agreements as to these rights, that at least is, or perhaps was, colorable, because it was at least at a facial level an application of generally applicable contract principles. Now, the effect of this, as Hira Aragaki said in a recent article, is quite profound. It creates this debate about how do we differentiate between generally applicable contract principles as applied in arbitration and true rules, whether judge-made or legislatively, that discriminate against arbitration. But I would suggest that Professor Aragaki asks the wrong question. The way to think about this is not in terms of exactly what the non-discrimination principle means, but what the non-discrimination principle does. What the non-discrimination principle does is it reallocates separation of powers at the state level. Much contract law develops at the state level through common law, and that common law is propounded by state courts. Consequently, through their exercise of their power to make common law, state courts enjoy a unique prerogative, one might say a superior prerogative to state legislatures, to regulate arbitration agreements under the guise of applying general contract principles. And not only does this expand power to state judges, but it constricts the power to state legislatures. For suppose that a state court concludes that an arbitration agreement is enforceable. The state legislature can do nothing about that. If the state legislature sought to overrule that decision, the FAA would immediately displace that legislation. But on the other hand, if a state were to find a arbitration clause unenforceable, the state legislature might well step in the gap and enact pro-arbitration legislation. Taken together, the foregoing doctrinal principles effectually reallocate power from state legislatures to state courts to affect their prescriptive jurisdiction over when arbitration agreements will be enforceable as a matter of federal law. Now, while this state of affairs is not necessarily wrong, it should give us pause. Does it really make sense to design a patchwork system where state judges hold the reins to regulate this important question? And this becomes particularly stark when one considers that the vesting of this power occurs irrespective of whether the state court judge is politically independent or instead must run regularly for re-election and thus raise funds from the very parties who may be appearing before those judges. Now, several responses to this objection are possible, and while I detail them in the book, maybe the explanation is that what's really occurring here is not simply an allocation of power from state legislatures to state judges, but indeed an allocation of power from the state to Congress. Against this backdrop, one might unite several recent Supreme Court decisions, including Concepcion, where the court, thanks to Annie Pincus's argument, held that the Federal Arbitration Act preempts California's application of its unconscionability doctrine to invalidate arbitration cases containing class waivers. But also Greenwood, which found that claims under the Federal Credit Repair Organization Act are arbitrable, and if Congress wishes to make them inarbitrable, it must speak clearly. Just as if Congress wishes to invalidate arbitration clauses containing class waivers, it must speak. States must not speak. Legislatures must not speak. Courts may not speak as to that question. And therefore, it's perhaps interesting to see this debate, which is ultimately a debate about the meaning of Section 2, as really a debate about the vertical separation of powers between the federal government and the states, and horizontally between state courts and state legislatures. How much time do I have?
Five.
I can do five. Third and final point, because I want to give John Vail lots of grist, because he's been such an important advocate in many of the arbitration decisions that I talk about in the book. The Due Process Clause. Nor shall any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property with the due process of law. We normally associate this with imposing certain restrictions on courts. We don't think about it as imposing restrictions on arbitration. Why? Well, intuitively, maybe arbitration is not state action, which is the view that most courts have taken. But as with Article III, this account has been too facile. We might argue, as Richard Rubin has done, that dispute resolution is a traditional state function. But I think that argument is wrong, principally because we know that courts still retain a residual power to review arbitrators' awards. So it's not as if the entire state function has been exported to the arbitrator. One might argue, as Rubin has done, that the judicial enforcement of arbitration agreements is significant encouragement of arbitration, drawing on the famous Shelley versus Kramer case that held that judicial enforcement of a racial covenant violated the Equal Protection Clause because the judicial enforcement was state action. Sarah Cole has argued that that's not right and gives the conventional explanation because Shelley versus Kramer has largely been limited to enforcement of racial covenants. But I think the better answer, the reason why arbitration is not state action, is that unlike Shelley versus Kramer, the private arrangement that the parties have made have no effect on third parties, whereas the racial covenant had an effect on parties that weren't in privity with the original covenant. But having concluded that arbitration is not state action doesn't end the question, doesn't end the discussion. I say in the second part of the book, does it matter that arbitration isn't state action? And I would say the answer is no. Why? Well, because through a variety of subconstitutional mechanisms, due process norms have filtered their way into arbitration. For example, the American Arbitration Association administers all employment, consumer, and healthcare arbitrations pursuant to a set of privately developed protocols that guarantee the employee a right to representation, that guarantee the employer or consumer a fact that they won't have to pay an excess share of the costs, that guarantee these individuals access to discovery, that guarantee these individuals that the arbitrator shall be knowledgeable and skilled, that guarantee these individuals the same array of remedies that they would be entitled to in civil court. What has happened, and this is in some sense not a coincidence because it grows in response to the death of the non-arbitrability doctrine, is a willingness by private arbitral institutions to embed in their own procedural norms constitutional principles. But this hasn't simply happened at the level of norm development. Both Article 5 of the New York Convention, which governs the enforceability of international awards, and Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act, which governs the grounds upon which arbitral awards can be vacated, likewise have been interpreted by reference to due process norms. And what this raises, and I talk about this at the end of the chapter, is a debate that's quite relevant today to the work of the CFPB. As you know, the CFPB is currently in the midst of a significant study deciding whether it will regulate or forbid the enforceability of arbitration clauses in consumer credit agreements. And my lesson to the CFPB is this, that before they act, they need to be very mindful of the success, and here I stress success, of private norm regulation to ensure fairness in arbitration. Christopher Hosel, one of the finest scholars in this field, just published a study that showed that in almost every consumer arbitration administered by the American Arbitration Association occurred in compliance, in 100% compliance with the due process protocols. And the virtue of having these constitutional norms be developed through private mechanisms rather than public mechanisms, they're easier to implement, they're easier to modify, they can be more comprehensive, they can create greater participation to stakeholders, and perhaps most interestingly, they can generate a dialogue between courts and the regulated interests. For those of you who have dug deep in this field, you will know that several courts have referred to the due process protocols, sometimes critically, as Chief Judge Edwards did in the D.C. Circuit case in Cole, encouraging significant reexamination of exactly how cost splitting and arbitration should work. On the one hand, if we have the company bear all the costs, it reduces the financial burden on the consumer. On the other hand, if we allow that to occur, there's a risk that the arbitrator might become captured by the person footing the bill. In other instances, courts have praised the due process protocols, as Justice Ginsburg did in her decision in the Greentree decision. And in other cases, courts have refused to enforce arbitration agreements in part because the terms of the agreement didn't comport with the due process protocols. And mind you, these were agreements that weren't subject to the protocols. But the courts were looking at the protocols as proxies for what was a fair arbitration. And a given clause failed that test because it didn't accord with these privately developed constitutional norms. Let me close with three conclusions and two future directions. Conclusion one, with the exception of federalism, constitutional law has had a limited direct doctrinal impact on arbitration. Conclusion two, notwithstanding the lack of direct doctrinal impact, constitutional law has had a profound effect on arbitration at the subconstitutional level through the interpretation of statutes, through the design of treaties, and through the development of private contractual norms, such as the due process protocols. And third, the effect of this seepage between constitutional law and arbitration law has been to stimulate a dialogue between courts and stakeholders that happens far more often in arbitration than it does in other fields of constitutional law. Looking ahead, two thoughts. One, I made a deliberate choice to root this book in United States law. It was what I knew best, and it was where I felt I could have the greatest impact. But the project is unquestionably amenable to a comparative undertaking. And one of the things that I'm most grateful to Dean White for is when she supported me when I received a Fulbright Fellowship, it enabled me to interact with colleagues from around the world in Austria, Italy, the United Kingdom, Australia, and elsewhere. And without exception, colleagues in every one of these countries could relate instances where their own legal systems had confronted the relationship between arbitration law and how their state was organized. And to the best of my knowledge, no book has looked at that comparative question. And the second question, for those of you who are more in the constitutional law scholar range, what explains the form that the norm has taken? Why, for example, are federalism norms directly incorporated through the preemption doctrine? On the other hand, why are due process norms privately developed? And why are the judicial review norms developed largely through treaty structure and statutory and treaty interpretation? With that, I'll end. Hopefully, I haven't spoken too long and answered a few questions, and to the extent I have, and I'll be happy to answer them after the commenters. Thank you.
Thank you much. Go.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here to support Beau Rutledge and this fantastic book. And at the risk of judging a book by its cover, I want to – are there copies of this book out there? People have this ready at hand. You know, I thought the cover – I was looking at this, and it's all wrong, right? It's an iStock photo of the Constitution, sure, but there's also this the scale of justice, which is the symbol of judicial power. This is anything but judicial, right? I mean, if you want to weigh questions of law or justice in this context, you wouldn't use the scales. I'm going to turn this phone off because I think I am not one of those AT&T customers subject to Concepcion. And a little arbitration joke there. This really should be either, if it's traditional arbitration, you know, the scale that says tear weight, whatever tear weight is in at the butcher shop, or it should be one of these really newfangled things. You step on its clear glass and it projects with laser precision. Whoo, you're up to 164 pounds. Congratulations. Diet time again, right? That particular kind of scale really should be the one here. Now, I go to some pains to say that because it turns out that modernity, or for want of a different word, the conflict between text and tradition and what the source of constitutional law is the true theme of this book. This is a book that I really think someone should read, even if they have absolutely no familiarity or interest in arbitration, because it is a grand tour in 200 pages of American constitutional law. It's a little bit like, I've got music, I've got rhythm, what else could I want? You've got separation of powers on the judicial side. You've got separation of powers against the executive. You have questions of federalism with respect to whose law. You've got questions of federalism with respect to whose procedure. You've got individual rights, both at the level of due process and the level of jury right. A classic right that we incorporate both directions against the states and against the federal government. And then we have a right that's classically not incorporable. It's perfect. It's every conceivable question of constitutional law, and there are even Eighth Amendment questions raised in this book. You can do whatever you want. It's projected here. It's the Rorschach test of American constitutional law. Now, I'm not being just, I don't want to be flip, because I know why I'm here. I'm here because what Beau Rutledge wants really to do is to say, Jim, you made all these arguments about Article 2 and Article 3, and you had your head handed to you in the Canadian softwood lumber case. Okay, so since I'm here on courtesy of AEI and the Federal Society, I'm going to give Beau what he wants. Yes, Beau, you were right. I was wrong. These very, very brittle arguments that I made based on, you know, straightforward textual readings of Articles 3 and 2 that our former common boss, the Honorable Clarence Thomas, Associate Justice from Georgia, you know, and look, I'm one of the few people who knows the difference between Clark Central, the big public school closest to Beau, and Clarkston, my alma mater in DeKalb County. Very few people know that. We're Georgians, we're Thomas alumni, and I have to admit, he's got the better of the argument. Okay, so there, I have done my part. Now, here's why he's right, or at least in the Holmesian sense that the law is what the courts will actually do and not what professors say they should do. Okay. If you and we are, after all, and I'm going to work in a reference, two references to religion and to marriage. Gee, why would that be on anyone's brain today? One is this. The consent theory is wrong because you can't just have private consent rule everything. Because if it were, people could get divorced anytime. I don't like you, you don't like me. Let's call the whole thing off, right? You say tomato, I said tomato. You can't just call the whole thing off. We don't let people just say, I consent out of this, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. Hey, I'm on Match.com. That's not how it works. We say that there are deep structural reasons independent of consent. It works for marriage, which is what brings us together. And it also works for separation of powers in American constitutional law. There are values in the horizontal arrangement of powers within the federal government that transcend what individual parties to a commercial relationship may or may not find convenient. So, with that in mind, we can't just throw caution to the shore, CFTC versus shore. We actually have to consider what the Constitution says in Articles 2 and 3. Now, if you take my 1992 article, and look, if I, a Thomas clerk, an alumnus of the Thomas Chambers and Alan Morrison agree on this, it's got to be right, right? And that's always been my running joke, and we do agree on this. Alan Morrison was the one who encouraged me to write that article, and he and I would both say, look, Article 3 at some point has to mean that you can't strip all the jurisdiction of the federal courts. Article 3 does say all cases, some controversies. Doesn't it say that? It does say that. And Article 2 does say, look, if you're an officer of the United States, you've got two ways to be appointed. If you're a principal officer, it really needs to be by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. And if you're not one of those, if you're an inferior officer, okay, by law, it might be the president himself or herself. It might be a head of department. It might be a court of law. But if you're not one of those inferior officers, you can't be appointed that way. And if you're an officer and you're not appointed that way, and binational panelists in NAFTA or before that U.S.-Canada free trade, they're not appointed by anybody. They're not within our system. Now, to say, well, Congress didn't do it, they're not aggrandizing themselves. Oh, well, that's great. But that's fine, thanks. So Congress didn't arrogate power to itself. But it gave it away from other people. It's like saying, well, gee, you know, I don't think divorce is something ought to be given freely, but I just don't like the fact that my brother Harry is married to that Herod and Sally, so I want to divorce them for you. It's a little bit like that. When Congress says we're going to ratify a treaty and pass implementing legislation that undermines the constitutional fabric, you are doing bad things. But that's not what the law actually says. And we do have to acknowledge that there are instances where the law, even constitutional law, is not what the Constitution says. It's really funny to me, but the people who take constitutional text most seriously on the Supreme Court of the United States are the first to say that the 11th Amendment does not mean what it says. Isn't that amazing? There are any number of things that we can say in both ideological directions or any ideological direction where the Constitution doesn't mean what it says. And here's why. We are, after all, in what for many Americans is one of the holier weeks of the year. And there is a fundamental division, at least within one side. You know, it's all a form of Judaism. I'm a Catholic by convert, but I'll admit it's really the unauthorized sequel to the original Hebrew Bible. And those of us who follow the unauthorized sequel divide between the Protestants and the Catholics by and large. And the Protestants are those who actually believe in text. And then there are the Catholics who actually say, text? Really? Who needs text? I've got tradition. Hey, I'm just riffing a non-Christian constitutional scholar by the name of Sanford Levinson, who says it's all, who's Jewish, but says it's really just Catholics and Protestants. On these issues, the Catholics have got the upper hand in many, many ways, right? That it's not about the text of Articles 2 and 3. It's about the fact that if we were to read these articles literally, we would bring not just arbitration, but American administrative law to its knees. Now, there are people in this organization and in the federal society who would say, and your point is, that's what we've wanted, right? Yeah, but, you know, to do that would mean to say, basically, it's like, okay, so, you know, there really is nothing saying that priests should be celibate, nothing in text, and they have to be men, but it's always been that way. You're just saying that you can't have it that way? Well, you know, there's a guy named Francis who might have might kind of put me under excommunication if I were to keep pushing that point too loudly. Why? Not because it's textual, because that's the way it always has been. And if you honor tradition in government the way you do in religion and social relations, you can't just blow that off because the text doesn't say so. So I think if you come back to these questions of Articles 2 and 3, what this book is about at a deep level is why, notwithstanding clarity and simplicity, of course they're not officers of the United States. Of course they are officers of the United States, excuse me. Of course these are private rights. Just because in ex parte Bakelite Corporation says they're not doesn't mean that. You tell me that getting a countervailing duty against a Canadian timber producer is not a private right to you. You're not in the timber business. The whole point is you want these duties assessed against your competitors the way you want your competitors, if it were a federal antitrust suit, to be rocked for a Section 2 violation for engaging in predatory pricing. It's exactly the same thing. Notwithstanding all that, I'm right. But of course, the court doesn't say so, so I'm wrong. All right, so I'm not gonna get too worked up about that. Losing happens all the time. After all,
just
these
things.
It's okay. It's I mean, I'm not final either. All right. You know, I don't have life tenure. I have academic tenure. It's not quite, you know, not quite the same thing. All right. So instead of just holding court in Articles 2 and 3, I want to take a shot at some of the this big issue. The question is this. Beau Rutledge says to us, you know, why is it that in arbitration, for that matter, this is true of all of constitutional law, separation of powers questions tend to involve treaties and big federal statutes. And at the other end, individual rights, well, gee, involve cases involving individuals. That's really shocking. And then there's this middle ground of all the federalism cases, and they seem to involve actual application of constitutional doctrine. It's like, well, okay, that's true. We do have, I've got 5 minutes, 3 minutes. Okay, so I'm going to get this real quick. Let's go through this. Treaties and separation of powers. Then you have at the other extreme, consumers and individual rights. And then somewhere in the middle, we call it merchant law. These are all arm's length transactions involving big commercial sophisticated players, and that's where federalism takes place, right? It's not hard to see that pattern. Now, why is this so? I think this is pretty, to me, it's pretty clear. This is the second challenge that Beau Rutledge put out. And it's pretty clear because, look, even though obviously individual powers, ask whether Chadha, Jagdish Chadha, was individually affected by his case. Of course he was. But it really came down to whether Congress got to veto something. All right, it's really all about federal structure, and that's why big things like the old Immigration and Naturalization Act or in treaties in these cases would actually be implicated in separation of powers cases. It's not at all surprising that the middle range is about merchants. Why? It's a little bit like this. Do we believe that the United States, when it comes to arbitration, could be a single player among the rest of the world, and we can allow one of our states to become the Belgium, as it were, of arbitration, where you say, hey, come here. If you choose Belgium as your arbitral forum, our judges will not mess with you. But other states might say, you know what, our judges will enforce some kind of quasi-constitutional norm through aggressive interpretation of Article 5.1b of the New York Convention. That's another choice that you can make, but that's basically what it means to engage in federalism, whether it is within the United States or within the European Union or as between American, European, Asian, other jurisdictions. So ultimately, and I know I've got to wind up here, I do think that this is constitution. The big theme of this book is constitutional law by means other than the Constitution. Right? It's always, always, always using the avoidance theory. If you don't think constitutional law is not made through statutory interpretation, you obviously have never studied preemption. You've never studied dormant commerce clause. You've never studied the Catholic bishop principle in constitutional interpretation, Holy Trinity, a lot of ecclesiastical cases. You've never done that. You've obviously never thought about how constitutional norms affect international law. We get all worked up about international law affecting American constitutional law. We should be spending a lot of energy seeing how American constitutional law affects international law. And finally, for constitutional doctrines and principles to be enforced through private means, isn't that, after all, what Brothers Karamazov really wanted? It's not the Western tradition of the state hoping the church wanting to be the state, right? That's basically Rome and its pathology, according to the Russians. Really, this is the church wanting to become the state. The state wanting to become the church. It would be great if we could get private individuals arranging their affairs, asking the courts to enforce rights and responsibilities vis-a-vis each other according to highfalutin norms of juries and due process that the government guarantees when it prosecutes you criminally. The whole point is, can we use arbitration as a dispute resolution mechanism that inspires individuals to treat each other as if they were states treating their citizens? So with that, I'll yield. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Well, he gave me a couple of segues there, but I have to start, you know, this idea of text and tradition and Catholics just reminded me of a little story. And the short version of it is an ex-pope is in heaven. He's a very studious guy, and he's studying in the heavenly archives very happily for years and years and years. And all of a sudden, one day from his library table, there's a scream. And the librarians run over, and the Pope is doubled over at the table. And they say, Your Holiness, what's wrong? What's wrong? And he points to the text on his desk, and he says, it's celebrate! Now, I'm just coming off my failed papal campaign myself. I was out there, John for Pope, a white smoke kind of guy. It didn't work for me. But I'm going to keep trying. You know, I need a good job in Rome. So if somebody's got, or Paris. Paris is good, too. So I want to talk about a couple of things. But let me tell you first, I'm going to talk primarily about cases under the Federal Arbitration Act, the Federal Arbitration Act itself, and not the New York Convention. And my discussion when I talk is going to be primarily about the effect of what's called mandatory arbitration, one of the few rhetorical battles my side won. It came up with a decent term first, and that's the enforceability of pre-dispute arbitration clauses. And I'm going to start with a couple of statements that I won't get into long. Anybody who wants to debate these, I've got nowhere to go tonight. I'm happy to hear and talk with you. But first is that Congress never passed the Federal Arbitration Act that you see today. Southland was wrongly decided. At one point, five sitting members of the Rehnquist Court agreed with that. And Southland ignores the text of the statute as a whole. The statute was written as a set of procedural rules to apply in the federal courts. And it was written, you know, the legislative history is really clear on this. And I think most compellingly, it's written, the Congress in 1924 did not think it had the power under the Commerce Clause to pass a preemptive statute. This was pre, you know, the Darby and the other Depression-era Commerce Clause decisions. So I will say that. And Congress never passed a statute creating a federal policy in favor of arbitration. The federal policy in favor of arbitration has been created by the Supreme Court. Congress passed a statute that had one purpose. It was to require courts to provide the remedy of specific enforcement of arbitral agreements. It was about remedy. It wasn't about arbitration in any broader sense. Because courts enforced arbitration agreements all the time. They said, okay, they've breached their arbitration agreement, prove your damages, we'll give them to you. But we're not going to specifically enforce your arbitration agreement. And that's what the Federal Arbitration Act was about. And it was designed to cover big commercial disputes, disputes between sophisticated, high-level actors, and disputes primarily about commerce. And that is a good segue into my point, because Paul Rutledge is a smart guy, right? If I buy his premises, I'm toast. So I'm going to take him at a premise, because he makes a statement in the book. He says that an arbitration agreement is, quote, an essentially private commercial transaction. Now, I note even his qualification in there. He's got that essentially in there. He's not so sure about the whole thing. But I don't think so. And I'm going to say why. the resolution of disputes was described by Chief Justice Marshall in Marbury versus Madison as one of the first duties of any government. So here we have a concept that's very different from the way we normally, as children of the Enlightenment all, think about rights. We think about rights as limitations on the power of the state. Here we are dealing with not limitations, but one of the duties that flows to the state as a result of the social contract. The first duty of the state is to provide remedies when people are aggrieved. It's a different kind of thing. It's implemented in part through the First Amendment right to petition. And despite Justice Scalia saying from the bench when it was asserted, where do we decide that? This court has recognized a protected First Amendment right to sue. And that's to sue private parties. It's also implemented in the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial. And the right to jury trial is also an important allocation of powers question, because it's a question of who decides things. And juries are not appointed, they're not elected. In fact, the genius of them is that they are selected at random, essentially. And you can best view juries, I think, as the citizens saying to the state, we don't trust any of you suckers to decide these things. Elected, appointed, anybody else. We're going to decide these ourselves because we know you're all corruptible in one way or another. And we trust a bunch of us selected at random better than we trust any of you. And that's what the right to jury trial is about. It's an important question about who decides and the allocation of powers. So in those two senses, I don't think that an agreement, a contractual agreement to arbitrate, is essentially a private matter. It has very important public law implications. And I'm going to talk about some of those. Now, in the original conception of the FAA, those public law concerns were probably not going to be very important. Because what do you have? You have equal parties, and you have commercial disputes. The arbitral disputes were primarily about things, you know, you shipped me red widgets, I needed blue widgets, they're worth less, you owe me money, or I don't want them, or whatever. They're essentially applying default rules of commerce. And while we may have some particular interest in particular default rules of commerce, primarily we're interested in there being a rule. It's usually more important that there's a rule and that it's clear than it is what the rule is. I contrast those disputes with the kind of disputes that are subject to mandatory arbitration today under the Federal Arbitration Act. And those are disputes about, for example, things like paying the minimum wage, employment discrimination, matters that came into being because of important historical events in the country, and matters that express important political judgments about how those things should be decided. So when those kinds of disputes are resolved in arbitration, they're resolved by persons who are not publicly accountable. They're resolved in private. You know, there's been few greater beneficiaries of the Federal Arbitration Act than Holiday Inns, because they rent a lot of conference room for arbitrations, right? The hotel and motel industry is a fan. And, you know, if you're a reporter, you can't necessarily be admitted to an arbitration. You can't necessarily find out what happened. Unlike you can with disputes in courts. So, for example, Bo and I were talking before, I'm involved in a nursing home arbitration case that's pending at the Supreme Court. And, you know, one of the things that I say about nursing home arbitration clauses is that they're about being able to bury your dead in private rather than subject them to these cases to public scrutiny. That's what they're about. And what are class action bans in arbitration clauses about in credit card agreements, things in that? They're about avoiding class actions. That's what they are. They're liability limitation mechanisms. Andy, sorry. that's what they are. And they are, it is mandated by federal law that these agreements are specifically enforceable. Now, that trenches on judicial power. It trenches on state judicial power. It's an odd statute that tells a state court, a federal statute that tells a state court that it must give a particular remedy. Now, specific enforcement is a legal remedy, actually not an equitable remedy. But even so, that's an odd federal statute, which I think goes back to my point about another reason why Southland is wrongly decided. It deprives those courts, and I was glad to hear Bo say that state courts have a lawmaking function. You know, this idea that courts don't make law is BS. I'm sorry. This is a modern idea that has flowed from federal jurisprudence into the jurisprudence of the states. This was never true of state courts. When they had the Constitutional Convention, yeah, they said, no, we don't want federal courts deciding common law disputes. We don't want them to do that. But that wasn't because they thought they were legislative matters. It was because they wanted the state courts to decide those disputes. They acknowledged the lawmaking function of the state courts in the traditional common law vein, courts, torts, contract, property. So when these things are forced to arbitration, you lose the public scrutiny and you lose the grist for those mills, for those public bodies to perform their public role of interstitially making common law by deciding those kinds of disputes. They are robbed of that function by this. It is ouster. And I think that that is not wrong. The second point I talk about, especially for people in this room, there are probably people who still believe in choice. And the idea that, I mean, this is a generally applicable contract problem, is that courts have come to enforce anything. You know, how many of you read the terms and conditions of the last app that you downloaded before you downloaded it and agreed to all those terms and conditions, which, you know, might have had in there that you guaranteed that you would enslave your firstborn child to the computer company that made the app? Some of you may know Paul Carrington from Duke. Paul actually put up a website and that said no arbitration, no anything else, no everything in Durham under the rules of the Durham local courts, and signed all his agreements that, subject to the terms and conditions at www.paulcarrington.com, and it's the website was conditions for doing business with Paul or Betsy Carrington. I've fantasized about the case that would come up with that. But this idea of choice, I'll leave you with it. We talked about, you talked about private bodies being entrusted to develop due process norms. With regard to medical procedures, medical arbitrations, in the late, right at before the turn of the century, there was a big confab with the American Arbitration Association, the American Bar Association, the American Medical Association, the three biggest stakeholders in medical disputes. And they developed a due process protocol for arbitration. And their conclusion, which cannot be implemented under the Federal Arbitration Act, is there should never be enforcement of pre-dispute arbitration regarding medical disputes because it is impossible that there would be real consent to that agreement. So that's about my time. I'm happy to, I'll be here.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we've agreed to go directly to sort of questions from the audience. I ask you to identify yourself, please, and keep your questions, well, kind of with a question mark at the end, and not in the way that teenagers talk. And keep them brief. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm Sam Ryan, retired Navy JAG. John, you talked about medical arbitration. Are you talking about medical billing, alleged medical malpractice? What are you talking? What were you talking about?
Disputes about care. About not billing disputes, but disputes about disputes with patients, about the quality of care. Andy. Come on, Andy, you're way in.
Let's go.
Well, I guess I wanted to ask John about the last point that he made, the consent point, because it seems to me, you know, in our modern economy, we don't just not actually consent to arbitration clauses. We don't consent to any of the terms in the contracts with which we do business with a whole range of providers. And I guess you could say we're going to stop all of that and we're going to force companies to individually negotiate all of the terms with their many tens of millions of customers, or say what I think the courts have said, which is not, in fact, we'll enforce everything, but we will apply unconscionability doctrine in cases where it's a take it or leave it proposition and a consumer is involved, and we'll essentially limit in arbitration clauses and in non-arbitration clauses, our willingness to enforce things that are unfair based on whatever standard that particular state applies. And I just don't understand why arbitration clauses are on a different footing than anything else. And so why your theory doesn't mean we're going to sort of do away with mass contracting, and which provide lots of benefits to consumers.
Well, you know, the idea that commerce would come to a screaming halt if people stopped enforcing all the terms of click-through agreements or something seems to me to be pretty far-fetched. My guess is that it wouldn't. It wouldn't at all. The old rule, the rule was basically that you don't enforce anything that's a surprise, although that wouldn't work for arbitration now because you got to be an idiot if you're surprised it's there. They're in everything. They're in everything that you sign. They're ubiquitous, right? But as a public policy matter, which the FAA preempts, I mean, these concerns that I talk about losing democratic values and losing decision-making capabilities. I mean, what the result of the FAA now, right? What has it done? It has empowered, in the same way that Citizens United does, it has empowered disproportionately a class of corporate managers, and not shareholders, not members of corporations, but the managers of corporations, in practicality. That's exactly what it does. And it's transferred great decisional authority to them and to arbitrators who are not in any real way publicly accountable. And who are generally chosen by that same group of corporate managers. So you would expect that they're going to pick people that reflect their own values. So over time, you get a profound skewing of decision making, I think. Right.
I'm sure other people have questions, but I guess I'd just say I think that's a little bit of a caricature of the system. In the real world, for example, in consumer arbitrations, AAA picks the arbitrators. Each side has a veto, but it's not as if either side is picking the people, especially in small consumer arbitrations. It's basically, you know.
Well, Andy, there aren't any big consumer arbitrations because there are no class actions. Of course, there's always NAF to throw back at you.
If I may just kick in something here, there's a point that Bo makes in his book that I think is responsive to this discussion. He says, you know, it's interesting. If this were all just private lawmaking, completely unfettered, you would expect in a world of unequal bargaining power, and I'll just say, by the way, the most overrated case of the last 25 years is Citizens United. But that's a separate event. All right, I just could not let that go. I'm sorry. It's like if this case didn't exist, it wouldn't make a difference either way. But that's a separate question. And I do think that the key point in this book that's responsive to this is, you know, you would expect in pure private lawmaking in a world that is caricatured this way, that you have big, evil, publicly traded corporations with their 10Ks, and, you know, oh, they're traded at, you know, microseconds with huge shares. That's scary. Those people steamroll people who are living on Walmart coupons, not on Wall Street coupons, right? It's the coupon clip collectors versus the coupon clippers. In that caricatured world, you would expect these arbitration clauses to be absolutely devoid of procedural protection, and yet they are not.
No, I disagree with that, but I'll come back.
All right, we can come back to that. And I think the reason is, it's very simple. Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. You can push to a point where it is completely unconscionable and you will get no enforcement. You can push to such a point where you can say, welcome to not Google, but Dougal. And if you work for Dougal, you are a complete serf. Over there, you get free meals, you get workouts, you get night time off, you get to commute from home. Take that, Marissa. Over here, you are worthless. And you sign an arbitration clause that basically says you've got a discrimination claim on sex, on age, on race. You get nothing. No, it won't work that way because no one would actually take that job. No one is going to wind up in a world of consumer choice going with the company whose arbitration clauses are completely abusive as long as there is substantive competition elsewhere. That's a different question, and we might not have it. But I do think that in the end, there is a countervailing value. And I have to side with Andy Pincus on this one. There is a AAA process, and the people who want to do this because it does pay well, it's a nice way of making a living that doesn't require running for judicial office, writing law review articles, or billing hours. You don't get to do this work unless you develop expertise and some reputation for fairness. So there is a self-enforcement mechanism. We do believe in markets in this particular room, don't we, or not?
Let me see. So I think that my first reaction is with Andes, which is to say that the logical outgrowth of John's argument is that we throw either all the take-it-or-leave-it terms on consumer contracts out, or we treat the arbitration clauses the same way that we treat the other terms. But just to sort of tie it in with something that I talk about in the book in the discussion of federalism, just as Andy's a very effective lawyer, John's a very effective lawyer too. And the point that I would leave you all as to this debate is this, that when Andy wins, essentially what happens is the contract stays as is. But given what Section 2 of the FAA has done, and saying if you want to invalidate these things, you need to amplify your generally applicable contract principles. When John wins, what happens is not simply that the arbitration agreement gets bounced, but Florida or California or whatever state may say something quite more profound about its unconscionability doctrine or its public policy doctrine. And so one effect of the tradition of Section 2 that the court has developed is to force onto state courts this rather stark choice of values that are exemplified in the debate that Andy and John are having. And we might ask ourselves, is that appropriately the place where that debate should be occurring? And to the extent we think no, we might look at what the court has been doing in its recent decisions as a type of retreat from the careful balance of federalism values that sort of animated the world in which Southland and First Options kind of coexisted. And it's precisely for that reason that the debate in some quarters has now shifted to Congress, which, as some of you know, has been quite active in the last decade or so in slowly chipping away at the arbitrability of certain types of disputes, has considered bills that would impose procedural fairness requirements on arbitration clauses that treat them differently from other contract terms, because that's something that Congress can do that the court's saying states can't do. And so I think that the debate that John and Andy are having is quite illustrative of the theme that I'm trying to convey, which, to sort of Jim's point, you know, don't just sort of look for the constitutional issues in the latest Supreme Court decision, but look at them at more of a subliminal level. And let me tie that in briefly with the one response that I would give to Jim in sort of the spirit of humility, which is that in some sense, I'm wrong and Jim's right in the following sense. Yes, the Canadian softwood lumber arguments didn't prevail, but don't lose sight of the fact that the lawyers in the Justice Department and in OLC and in the State Department, when they are drafting and revising the model bilateral investment treaties, are very, very mindful of the constitutional tripwires that Jim's scholarship has laid. If you go back and look at the NAFTA implementing legislation, you'll see something quite remarkable in it, which is there's a whole section that basically says, here's how NAFTA is going to be implemented. We're going to have these bilateral dispute resolution boards. They're going to enter these decisions. And if these decisions are essentially going to be implemented by the executive branch, period, paragraph. However, if the NAFTA implementing legislation that we've just passed is declared unconstitutional, here's what's going to happen. Everything the NAFTA dispute resolution boards have enacted are going to become an executive order. And because it becomes in the form of an executive order, as opposed to an award being handed down by these three officers, or I guess five officers of the United States, that corrects the constitutional defect. Now, the constitutionality of the escape hatch has never been tested, but the very fact that Congress and the State Department had to go through the painfulness of figuring out what the heck are we going to do if this thing gets thrown out should illustrate to you how important these constitutional arguments are influencing legislation as it gets made. I'm reminded of a statement, and I'm paraphrasing, that's it was either Seth Waxman or Doug Letter made in the softwood lumber litigation. And essentially what they said was this. They basically said, if you throw this out, if you declare the NAFTA system unconstitutional, you are doing nothing less than ripping out the keystone of U.S. trade agreements. Because the trade agreements are only as effective as a dispute resolution mechanism exists to back up disputes over the trade agreements when they arise. And so even though, you know, Jim may have lost the short-term fight, I would say Jim's won the war in a way, because he has shaped the debate in a way by pushing policymakers to move beyond the facile consent public rights arguments to think quite profoundly about how the treatment of arbitration awards fits within the constitutional architecture in a way that may never make it in a con law casebook, but in some ways may be much more profound than a decision that does.
Stuart.
I'm Stuart Gerson. To what extent, if you do that, if you import these due process notions into arbitration generally, do you make arbitration less attractive to the people it was originally intended to serve, commercial participants?
So that's an excellent question, and I think it's when at this point, and this maybe ties in a little bit to the fact that both Jim and John are at this table, the answer may depend on whether one is talking about domestic arbitration versus international arbitration. With respect to international arbitration, I think to the extent that these procedural protections are built in, it doesn't have too substantial an effect, because there are still very powerful incentives that will drive parties to arbitrate, most notably the fact that while the U.S. has not ratified any bilateral or multilateral judgment convention, it is a party to the New York Convention, and therefore the same piece of paper that says Chen wins and Rutledge loses, if rendered by an international arbitrator, is much more enforceable than if it's rendered by a judge. On the other hand, with respect to the procedural protections built into domestic arbitration, I think some of the debates over class arbitration sort of illustrate the pitfalls. That if one simply tries to import all of the bells and whistles of a garden variety civil dispute into an arbitration, that will have an effect in disincentivizing some parties to enter into it. Not all parties, but what and I think actually, notwithstanding that, that speaks in favor of the private mechanism for the following reason. And it goes back to something that John and I were talking about a little while ago. And it goes to this concept of unbundling. If you think about the consequence of merging law and equity, one effect is that it made civil procedure a lot easier to teach. But the problem is that, or Andy may disagree with that, maybe it made civil procedure harder to teach. The sense in which it made it easier to teach is that you have a bunch of first-year law students and you can say to them, you know, you file a breach of contract action and it's going to be sort of litigated under the same set of rules as when you file a Title VII action. Well, not so when you're filing, say, an employment arbitration or a consumer arbitration or a healthcare arbitration. And therefore, I think, notwithstanding the pitfalls of private procedural protections either embedded in arbitration agreements or more often incorporated by reference as a result of best practices that are articulated by arbitral associations or industry associations, it permits a nuance and a flexibility that tailors the particular procedural protections and protocols to the type of dispute. What one might need in an employment dispute might be different than a consumer dispute, which isn't to say you can't overregulate it and discourage people from using the mechanism, but that there's a nimbleness to it that remains provided the private mechanism becomes the means by which these procedures in arbitration are regulated.
Anthony Deirdre, Federalist Society. Professor Rutledge, I gather from your talk that you at least slightly favored this idea of manifest disregard as a way of sort of returning more towards an appellate merits review in some cases. And my question is, doesn't that become sort of the exception that swallows the efficiencies of the rule, and then there will be magically be big firms who will discover in any case where the arbitration was lost that the judge manifestly, you know, the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the law? And so how do you sort of avoid a resulting habeasization
right.
of arbitration proceedings where it's just continuous attempts to resolve something finally?
That's a great question. And let me start by saying that parts of the book are expressly normative. My discussion of some of the federalism principles is meant to critique the court in a way for not thinking deeply enough about how it's allocating power. The discussion of manifest disregard, or perhaps in light of the Stolt-Nielsen and the Oxford Health Plan argument on Monday, we might call it the manifest disregard section 10A4 question. I personally am not normatively comfortable with. I think about it more in terms of giving folks a way to conceptualize why the court seeks to cling to this doctrine. You know, the manifest disregard doctrine began essentially as a type of justification for the non-arbitrability doctrine. That because awards are only reviewable for manifest disregard of the law, it can't be the case that Congress, when it set up the FAA, intended to permit arbitration of Securities Act claims. When the non-arbitrability doctrine was interred, one might have thought that the manifest disregard doctrine was interred with it. And yet it was only 6 years after the Rodriguez case that Justice Breyer in First Options, lo and behold, dusts off the manifest disregard doctrine and said, well, of course, arbitration awards are unenforceable under Section 10A and for manifest disregard. And so, well, gosh, I guess we have manifest disregard again, and then along comes Hall Street. Again, a case that has nothing to do with the manifest disregard doctrine. And Justice Souter says, well, because Section 10 grounds are mandatory and parties can't contract them around, at least in federal court, and whatever this manifest disregard doctrine is, maybe it's just an expression of the Section 10 grounds, we don't have to decide. So maybe Hall Street's dead again, or maybe manifest disregard is dead again, as some courts of appeals say. But then Stolt-Nielsen comes along, and Justice Alito, again, not a manifest disregard case, but Justice Alito drops this very cryptic footnote that basically says, well, whether we call it manifest disregard or exceeding powers under Section 10A4, doesn't even matter. Whatever it is, we know it and we see it, and the arbitrator did it here. And so manifest disregard's back alive again. And then we have the Oxford Health Plan argument on Monday, where you see one of the most interesting coalitions of justices. John, correct me if I'm wrong, but as best I can tell, Justices Scalia, Breyer, and Sotomayor, right?
In the same place.
All in the same place saying, well, of course there has to be a way. If the arbitrator says, you've asked me to resolve the dispute according to the contract, I'm going to shake the magic eight ball. The magic eight ball says Chen wins. I'm interpreting the contract. Therefore, Chen wins. That we can't do anything about it. And I think what I'm suggesting is not that I'm comfortable with it either as a matter of statute or as a matter of text or as a matter of my faith. But simply that if the court is, you know, it's probably, you know, trite and overdone for somebody to say the court just isn't thinking deeply enough about this. But I genuinely think, and I think maybe I can get John and Annie to agree on this, that the longer they sort of kick the can on what manifest disregard in Section 10A4 means, it makes life either hell or lucrative for litigators. Because
well, that's a good thing. We can agree on that.
Because you never know what case where the question presented all of a sudden becomes another manifest disregard case. And so I'm trying to provide the court a lifeline to sort of think it through in a principled way.
Before Michael shuts us off, let me just give you two things. I don't predict the court much, but I'm going to predict the court review isn't going to go away. And let me give you just two examples of why. Assume Stolt-Nielsen, right? Assume those facts. There's the stipulation. The arbitrator writes a decision that says, I've seen your stipulation, but you hired me to interpret a text. It's not part of the text. I reject it, and I find that you intended to allow class arbitration. That case goes to the court. They going to enforce that? All right. Second example. Assume the facts of Walmart, the Walmart case. But instead of coming from the Ninth Circuit, the Walmart case comes from an arbitral award. The court going to rubber stamp that? Yeah, Andy, that going to happen? Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, I won't put him on the spot. I'm just saying, I don't think so.
Let me just say one more thing, and then Michael will shut me off. And if that happens, going back to sort of my future directions, then the U.S. stands alone. Because even under the most watered-down version of manifest disregard, most developed countries would think it anathema that a court would even begin under whatever guise to peek beneath the merits of an award.
Oh, I can't resist, because it is almost opening day in that other great American religion, baseball. And the ultimate trump card of arbitration over courts is, and Andy Pincus is laughing because he knows where I'm going with this, Flood versus Kuhn says, oh, reserve clause means this, and we're not overruling federal baseball, and you're just federal baseball league, and you are stuck, Kurt Flood, playing forever for this team. That's all it means. Along comes Andy Messerschmidt and takes just one arbitrator looking at this like, what reserve clause? What do you mean? Free agency for all. And with that, I do think that we do have a very clear instance of arbitration being able on the substance of law to actually overcome a bad judicial decision. If that's possible, why not the reverse?
Maybe we should treat arbiters' decisions like decisions from the Ninth Circuit. They're presumptively wrong.